Well, this is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with mystery writer Diane Wei Leung. She's the author of two popular mystery novels set in present-day China, as well as a memoir of her experiences as a young political activist in China. The title of that book, Lake with No Name. She was a student at Beijing University and was active in the student democracy movement of 1989. And in part, that book tells the story of that movement, her experiences, and of the Tiananmen Square massacre that occurred 20 years ago this month. As we talk this morning with Diane Wei Leung, certainly questions are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about her. She was born in Beijing. She spent part of her childhood with her parents in a labor camp in a remote part of China, then another part of her childhood in Beijing with her mother when her parents had to live and work separately. She studied psychology at Peking University and was involved in the student democracy movement. She left shortly after Tiananmen, came to the United States, got a PhD in business administration from Carnegie Mellon, and taught business in the United States and also in the UK for a number of years. Her first book, Lake with No Name, was published in 2003 and has been brought out again for the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen. And she's the author of two mysteries, the first, The Eye of Jade, and the second, Paper Butterfly. They're both set in contemporary Beijing, and they feature a female private eye named Mei Wang. As we talk, again, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Diane Wei Leung, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. You know, I think one of the things that is attractive about the mystery is that it's very pliable and you can do a lot of things with it. And, of course, we know that there are mystery stories that are set in many different places and even different times. And I think that one of the things that people enjoy about reading them is that they get a sense of a different place in a time. And I know that you have said that in your writing, you're really hoping that people will learn something about China, particularly about what it is that people in China today think and feel, what their experience is like. So having said that, I wonder, is it actually possible in a few words to say something about that, what you think is on the minds and in the hearts of people who are living in China today?
Well, I think the people in China today are very much like the people who live elsewhere in the world, that they care about their loved ones and they have their daily struggles. And particularly in China, they have struggles in the ever-changing society that is losing lots of the thousands of years old tradition. And while a new capitalistic society is emerging very rapidly, I think all these sort of form a society today in China that is rich in layers and that has many emotions that can be shared by people living in other parts of the world.
Mm. Certainly, when we came to earlier the month and when we came to the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen, people all around the world were thinking about this and talking about it, and media was full of stories. I was struck by some of the things that I have read about the visits that you've made back to China since and your experience talking with university students in China today. And apparently, not only do they really not know what happened then, what happened 20 years ago, your experience is that they really don't want to know.
That's true. And I was very shocked when I spoke to them. And I wasn't exactly surprised when they appeared to not be aware of Tiananmen, because the Tiananmen event had been censored for the past 20 years. But I was struck by their reluctance of wanting to know what happened. In a way, they see China has moved on 20 years to the new generation of Chinese. It's almost ancient history. And they're very much concerned with now and tomorrow. And they want to move on, and they want to grab these opportunities that are coming their way. And they're not interested in politics as we were 20 years ago.
Well, that invites the question I'm sure that you're often asked, or at least I'm sure recently that you have been asked, and that is whether you think that the student democracy movement and the brutal crackdown that the government made, whether in fact that changed anything in China.
Well, the crackdown of June 4th, the student movement, certainly had very much determined China's path in its development in the past 20 years. Had China allowed the movement to flourish, perhaps the development would not have taken its path as it had. Perhaps we would see more opening up of political reform. But because Tiananmen was crashed, I think it is very, very difficult to judge its impact. And we must remember Tiananmen event happened within a very short 7.5-week period, although it was highly enthusiastically participated by over 1 million people across China. And it was a short-lived movement. It's difficult to say whether it's had a long-term impact. But I and my generations have reflected on this, and we believe that Tiananmen had served at least one purpose, which was to introduce the idea of democracy and freedom to the mass of Chinese population.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Diane Weilong. She's the author of two mystery novels set in contemporary Beijing, The Eye of Jade and Paper Butterfly. She is also the author of a memoir, Lake with No Name, that was first published in 2003 and has been reissued for the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. The book is available in paperback. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And also, if you'd like to read her mysteries, the first one, Eye of Jade, is also now out in paper, published by Simon & Schuster. And the other is a little bit more recent, so that you'll have to look for the hardcover version, but you can certainly seek them out. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about your experiences growing up, starting with the time that you were living with your parents in the labor camp. This would have been the time of the Cultural Revolution, when people like your parents, who were considered to be intellectuals, were sent out to the countryside to engage in physical labor. What was that like for you growing up in that atmosphere?
It was almost at the beginning of Cultural Revolution, when Mao sent all the intellectuals to labor camps to be reformed. And for me, I was 4 years old when I went with my parents. And the labor camp was in a remote mountain region of China, and rather close to where the earthquake happened last year. Mm-hmm. For me, it was the most magical and beautiful place to spend my memorable childhood. But I also remember the children who were looked after by grandparents who had come with their children to labor camp, and we were rooming free, and sometimes we realized some of our teachers would disappear and not to be seen again. And so it was a very strange way of growing up, and we know that our parents would go to the valley and work on building construction sites, and then they will have to do self-criticism sessions and watched over by army. To us, that was all part of what we thought life would be like.
Was it difficult for you being the child of people who were labeled intellectuals?
Absolutely. And when we were in the labor camp, all the children were black children. And we were all so-called anti-revolutionary. And so it wasn't that obvious. But when we moved back to Beijing, my mother took my sister and I to Beijing, and I went to primary school in Beijing, and I was bullied, and the peasant's children threw rocks at me and put ashes in my drawer. They chased me and beat me up every day because I was a child of intellectual.
And what did you think about that? Did you just think that was what life was like, or did that strike you as being somehow fundamentally wrong?
I thought that was how life was structured, and I tried desperately to be like them, to be read, to be revolutionary. And I tried desperately to find people I can report and earn these points and to become read, although I never managed to find anyone to report them. But I was very stressed out by that whole situation, and I had to flee the bullies, and I thought, if I could just do something and show my loyalty to Chairman Mao, my life would change for the better.
Mm. I understand that you started to become interested in being a writer, or start thinking about being a writer, perhaps when you were a teenager, and that when you told your mother that, she said, no, you don't want to be a writer. Being a writer is a dangerous profession. You don't want to do that. Do something else. What was it that attracted you to the idea of being a storyteller?
And I was at the Reader, and I very much enjoy reading. And by the time I was about 14 or 15, and the Western literature was allowed to be translated and to be sold in China, that was the beginning of 80s. And that was the first time that I got to read Dickens and Bronte's. I was very much enchanted by these stories. And, of course, I wanted to write, and I started writing poetry, etc. My mother used to be a professor of literature, and then her job was taken away from her, and when the universities were shut during the Cultural Revolution, and lots of her writer friends were thrown into jail. So she was adamant that I should give up this dream of ever becoming a writer, because being a writer means very much you are in the forefront of any political movement, and it's one of the most dangerous professions in China, as she told me.
Mm-hmm. How did you become interested in studying psychology?
Psychology was one of those new science that came to China after the universities were reinstated by Deng Xiaoping after Mao Zedong died. So it was a very interesting and new discipline. I was very much interested in that element of human psychology. And also, it was such a turbulent time in China, just coming out of Cultural Revolution and going through what Deng Xiaoping called open door policy. We got to meet the first foreigners that came to China, and we get to read foreign books that were first translated into Chinese. So it was that kind of time that I was very interested in how our emotions and our psychology reacting to this all opening up in China. So I became very interested in psychology, and I went on to study that in university.
Hmm. How did you become involved, politically involved, particularly with the student democracy movement? Was that something that seemed like a natural thing for you to be drawn into? Was there someone in particular, some person that was responsible, do you think, for your being involved?
I think both. In general, Beijing University was very much the cradle of student rebellion throughout the modern Chinese history. And when I was there in the 80s, the students have had democracy debates in salons, and we had underground student magazines, and I knew the writers, editors. And I also met someone called Deng Yi, who's highly involved with the underground student movement. And so through both sides, and I became involved with the democracy movement in Beijing University.
How much did you and the other students that were involved, how much did you think about the fact that this was dangerous?
In Beijing University, we felt very much protected, not only by the university walls, but also by our professors, by the fact that we were an elite group who had the duty to examine our country's future and perhaps exploring paths for our country to move ahead. And for us, we didn't feel that there was much danger as long as we stayed within our campus. But by 1986, when Hu Yaobang was stripped of his power after his sympathetic reactions to the students, and it became quite dark. One of my friends was the editor of Underground Student Magazine, and he came into the surveillance by the secret police. That was the very beginning that we realized the long arms of the secret police that perhaps could reach inside of the campus.
Mm-hmm. I realize we're compressing a lot in a small space here, but how was the decision made to take this, essentially to take your political action out into the street and to do something that would be so open and obviously so provocative?
It was triggered very much by Hu Yaobang's sudden death. And he died on the 15th of April. Before that time, the students within university campuses had been secretly planning a commemoration of 75th anniversary of what was called a May 4th movement, which was the first democratic student movement at the turn of the century that resulted in the Chinese Republic. Because the tension was already there. When Hu Yaobang died, the students took the opportunity and drew up petitions and asking for permission to send their representatives to his funeral to say goodbye to someone who had been sympathetic to the students. When that request was rejected, the students took to Tiananmen Square and sat outside in the square at his funeral. And that was when things became public. The confrontations became extreme. And soon after that, every day we went out to the streets, and the government sent in the police, and we were very successful at rushing the police line, and so the movement took on its momentum and resulted in the hunger strike in Tiananmen Square.
Mm. You know, I think that for example, here in the United States, when we look at a movement like the student democracy movement in China, or we look at what's going on today in Iran, or we look at popular movements aimed at pushing their governments to change, we perhaps assume that those people would want the same thing that we would want, that they're, when they use a term like democracy, that it, you know, maybe we don't all agree on what democracy means, but we sort of have some kind of idea about what the goals are. And in fact, the goals might be the same anywhere. I don't know. But if I ask the question, well, really, if we could go back there and we could walk around and talk to the students and say to them, what is it that you want? What would you like to see happen? How would you like to see China change? What sort of things would people have said?
Don't believe we truly understood what democracy and freedom of expression meant. And those were rather vague ideas that we got from reading books. And for the students, and we used those terms in probably a much too broad sense. At the very beginning, we simply meant, let us have a say in how universities are run, for example. It was a very, very basic demand. And then when we went out to the streets to demonstrate, we had a lot of support from the rest of the society within Beijing and across China. And some of these terms then were taken up by the rest of the population and painted on banners and carried around Tiananmen Square. And really, if you had a chance to talk to some of the people involved then, I don't believe that they would have a clear idea what democracy was, for example. And toward the end of the movement, the idea of democracy became clearer because of the foreign press had been reporting the event, had been talking to people in Tiananmen Square, and certainly the freedom of expression took on a much more important role because we were censored. The newspapers were shut down. They were not allowed to report on the student democracy movement. And so we felt very strongly that we wanted that freedom, freedom to speak our mind, freedom of the press, freedom of expression.
The events that we're talking about happened just a few weeks, just under 2 months from the death of Huyao Bang to the massacre. A lot of things happened in a relatively short period of time. But as things near the end, as things were ramping up, where there seemed to be a lot of tension and the concern about what exactly the government would do, how were people thinking about the possibility that the government would use force to end what was going on?
Among the students, we had always had this talk about giving up our life for a better China. But even in that kind of circumstances, we never thought that the government would bring in tanks and army and open fire with real artillery on the students. Even on the evening of June 3rd, when the news had come in that there might be confrontation, the student leadership, in fact, asked the students to go out to the street to help each other and with winter coats, which they believe will repel rubber bullets, and take wet towels for tear gas. And there was absolutely no idea among the student leaders or the students themselves that a real crackdown would happen with blood and death.
So you felt that was going to happen, it could not be avoided?
We thought that the government certainly would send in the troops by the 2nd and 3rd of June, mm-hmm. because we've seen the troops in the city and the tanks were on the outskirts of Beijing, which we managed to stop them from moving ahead. But we only thought that they would come in with rubber bullets and tear gas. And, of course, we were very shocked when the news came through that people were actually dying. And those stories and images were relayed back to university by messengers on bicycles throughout the night. And the student body was stunned. And I think the entire city of Beijing was shocked. That was why lots of the citizens of Beijing who were outside in the evening, because it was very hot in Beijing that summer, and they actually tried to help the students, and they actually rushed the soldiers that came forward because they were not aware that they were actually shooting with real bullets.
I think that's an important point to make, because in as much as we talk about this as being a student movement, there certainly were support. There was support for the students from people who were not themselves students, people who were older, maybe people who were old enough to be their parents, I'm sure.
Which was very interesting. When the students were having hunger strike in Tiananmen Square, we had hospitals donating services and ambulance and factories donating water and food for the supporters of the hunger strikers in Tiananmen Square. And every day there were over 1 million people marching with the students. We had a lot of support from the regular citizens of Beijing as well as across the China. That was one of the reasons I believe that students felt that we were invincible. In some ways, we were overconfident because we had all the support from the people, and we underestimated the power of the government.
Does anyone know how many people were killed?
No, I don't believe that number is known, and it has never been a proper investigation into that event since it happened 20 years ago.
You at the time had applied for the permission to come to the United States for more schooling, and apparently left to go to the United States just a few days, I think, after this all happened, after June 4th. It sounds as if you were lucky to manage to actually, after all of this had happened, that you were lucky to be able to go and to come to the United States.
Absolutely. I had received my scholarship, in fact, on the day that Hu Yaobang died. And I was able to apply for my passport. But after June 4th, the border was closed for many weeks, and I couldn't get my passport. At one point, when Beijing was under martial law, and it had gotten so dangerous that police would come at night knocking on doors and arresting people, I had to go to the countryside to hide for a week. But when the passport office was opened, about 5 weeks afterwards, I was able to get my passport and to leave China fairly quickly, and I left at the beginning of August for America.
Was there any discussion of your being involved in the student democracy movement, or was that not particularly an issue?
In order to get my passport, I had to have my employer write a letter to certify that I was not involved in the student movement. For anyone to get a passport, that letter is required, which meant that someone would have been brave enough to put his or her name down and to guarantee you. And once you leave, if anything happens, that person will be responsible. So we all had to produce this kind of letter. What was interesting was that lots of us who had passports approved were able to bring this letter, and people were very willing to help the students.
What was it like for you coming to the United States at that point?
It was very strange. When I arrived, I arrived in Virginia for William and Mary, and I remember standing on campus in Williamsburg and just remembering how quiet and peaceful the place was, and then realized for the first time in my life that no one was watching over me and no one was going to report anything I might say. It was a very strange feeling, and I think it was a very liberating feeling as well. And then because the media was censored in China during the June 4th movement, we had only the first-hand relay of stories, and we'd seen bodies, and we were seeing blood-stained shirts, etc. But I have not seen the footage that lots of people who lived in the West had seen, the tanks rolling down the Boulevard of Eternal Peace, and the horrific scenes of students and rushing and to rescue their comrades. So I saw those images after I arrived in America, and I couldn't believe how huge the event was and how absolutely horrific the crackdown was. Mm. And of course, a month later, and I also saw the Berlin Wall fall on TV. And that was an amazing moment.
We're just a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Diane Weilang. She was born in Beijing, spent part of her childhood, as she explained, living with her parents in a labor camp in a remote part of China, then another part in Beijing, with her mother when her parents were actually forced to split up to live and work in different places. She went on to study psychology at Peking University. She was involved in the student democracy movement and protested in Tiananmen Square. Shortly after that, she had the chance to leave China to come to the United States to go to school and got a PhD in business administration from Carnegie Mellon University and taught business in the U.S. and the U.K. for a number of years. Her first book, Lake with No Name, is a memoir of her experiences growing up in China. It was first published in 2003. And has been reissued for the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen. It is now available in a paperback published by Simon & Schuster, if you would like to read it. She is also the author of two popular mystery novels set in contemporary Beijing featuring a woman private detective named Mei Wang. Those books are The Eye of Jade and Paper Butterfly, and I think we should expect others in this series. So if you like to read mysteries, you should go out and take a look at them. She now lives in London. She's talking with us from there, and certainly questions are welcome. 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you know, I would expect that now having the opportunity to see what's going on in Iran would make you think of the experiences that you lived through in China during the time that we're talking about. I'm just curious about what some of your thoughts and feelings are watching the anti-government protests going on now in Iran.
Very much to remind me of what happened in China. What also reminds me was how technology, how communication helped both of these events. Tiananmen's event was the first time that it was broadcast through television, and from which we received so much support from overseas. And one of the reasons that it happened was because Gorbachev came to China for a visit, and he brought the press corps with him. And today, when I watch what happened in Iran, and I realize how immediate we see these images, not only on television, but also on the Internet. And we're very much involved. We see it happen real time. And I very much feel for these demonstrators, and I really feel for the people who were caught in the crackdown. It reminds me so much of what had happened, the misery and the death, and I hope there is some sort of success in what they do.
You know, here in the United States, the president, Mr. Obama, has come in for some criticism from people who somehow think that this country and that he, as the president, should be doing more to support the people who are protesting the government in Iran. And for his part, Mr. Obama has said, well, I think that as president, I have to be very careful here because you don't want the government to be able to point to the protest and say that somehow it's being orchestrated by the United States. So definitely he's in a difficult position there. But having said that, I'm interested both in what your thoughts were about at the time a country like the United States might have done to support the students then, and maybe also, you know, for the United States or the UK or, you know, any other government, what actually a government could do to support a movement like that.
20 years ago, we had a lot of support from particularly the United States. Not only we received a lot of donations, but also we had a lot of support and voices and the support from the U.S. government, and as well as cross the European governments. And I think that was very, very important for the students. And we felt that the rest of the world stood with us. Having said that, I also think that in subsequent years, after Tiananmen had happened, and given a few years had passed, I was pleased that United States and the rest of the world came back to China and engaged with the Chinese and help the China to develop economically, but also push China to reform politically. And therefore, we see China today as a better, more modern, and more developed international citizen, and certainly is moving toward the direction of a more responsible nation and in political sense.
And you've had the opportunity to go back since that point many times yourself.
Yes, I did. And in fact, I was invited to go back to China in 1996 to teach China's first MBA students. And I've been back since every year. And every time I go, I'm thrilled and also surprised to see the speed of development and the life changes that have happened to ordinary Chinese people. And I'm very pleased with the progress in economic terms. When I go and I also get together with my friends, we also see some of the injustices that are still existing in China, and we talk about what might have happened if the student would have succeeded. And we hope that the conditions, the social conditions would improve, and I would hope the reform will advance in a greater speed, and so that China will become a better and more prosperous country.
I read an article that said that, and maybe this was the result of a natural feeling of anger about what had happened in China, that maybe in your life today you've put some distance between your identity as someone who is Chinese and your identity now as a writer who lives in the UK and who writes in English. One of the things that struck me in this particular article, and you could tell me whether or not the person got it right, was that you're, at least maybe in your daily life, you avoid speaking Chinese, that you don't speak Chinese with your children, that they're not learning Chinese, which is something apparently your husband wasn't real happy about. Is that the case?
Well, I chose not to speak Chinese to my children because I write in English. As languages go, if I speak lots of Chinese, then my English would deteriorate. And then I must have to write in Chinese. My Chinese has unfortunately deteriorated over the past 20 years. So it was rather compromise, a difficult choice for me. I very much feel Chinese, although having traveled and lived in the West for 20 years, I'm not sure whether there has been certain movement within myself, and my identity clearly is now part Chinese, perhaps part an international citizen, especially since I've pretty much spent half of my life outside of China. Certainly, I have not put a distance consciously there, but unconsciously, perhaps it had happened.
Well, there, perhaps I was I was reading something into that maybe that wasn't there. I guess I was thinking that perhaps that was some kind of a political statement in effect, and it sounds as if it wasn't really.
I think sometimes I totally understand a journalist wants to write a compelling story, and sometimes certain things get twisted a bit.
Quite so. We have someone here who would like to talk with you. Let me again just very quickly say our guest is Diane Weilong. She is the author of the memoir Lake with No Name, A True Story of Love and Conflict in Modern China. It's about her growing up in China, her involvement in the student democracy movement, and her involvement there, and the events that led up to the Tiananmen Square massacre happened 20 years ago this month. It has been republished now and is available in paper, published by Simon & Schuster. She is also the author of two mystery novels, her first, The Eye of Jade, and the second, Paper Butterfly. They're set in contemporary Beijing, and they feature a female private detective named Mei Wang. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And here is someone to talk with us in Champaign, line one. Hello.
I am finding this a very, very interesting program. I think it's a wonderful background to have to come to this country and explain to us what happened in Tiananmen Square. I have been in China. I have not been in Iran. I want to make sure that everybody thinks in two different ways, because this is two very different situations, and I'm finding myself just slightly worried that there might be too direct a comparison made. But I think this is a wonderful program, and I am enjoying it. Thank you very much.
No, all right, thanks. Well, I certainly I hear what the caller is saying, and I would not want to suggest that somehow these two things are the same. But at the same time, I guess it doesn't. I wouldn't be surprised if people would somehow, watching what's going on in Iran, and particularly some of the dramatic pictures that we've seen of people who were injured or killed, like this one woman in particular that we've now seen, it seems sort of natural to kind of put those two things together in your head. And you can talk about this. You were there, so you can talk about it from personal experience. Clearly, there are important differences. We wouldn't want to say that somehow these two things are the same, but I don't know. Again, as I've said, I guess I feel like I can't quite help but wonder, well, how are those two things the same? Or ask you, as someone who is there, you know, what's it look like to you?
Well, certainly it reminded me of what happened in China 20 years ago. And obviously there are differences. And what happened in Iran is the result of an election, which wasn't happening in China 20 years ago. And there was any degree of democracy in China or any degree of free election. But what struck me as familiar was how the government and the police force reacted to the demonstrators. On one hand, you have a heavy-handed police force with artillery. And on the other hand, you have unarmed protesters.
We have just about, 7, 8 minutes left. Again, if someone would like to call in, talk with our guest, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk just a little bit about how it is you got involved in writing mysteries. And it's sort of my understanding that before writing the first, before writing Eye of Jade, that you weren't particularly a big mystery writer. And that it was, in fact, your agent, your literary agent, who said to you, well, you know, maybe you might want to think about writing a mystery, and that would be a good kind of form to use to write about things that you actually really want to write about.
That's correct. And I was writing a different kind of literary historical novel set in China 2,000 years back. When I met my agent, and he introduced me to a certain type of mystery genre, the kind that had very strong sense of place, and the Raymond Chandler's, for example. And I was very much caught by how moody, how atmospheric those writings were. And I realized that he was right, that mystery novel with certain type of crime and would provide a great structure and vehicle for me to write about China, how people live, and to write about different classes of people and how they struggle through their daily lives. And that's how I started to write mystery.
And maybe we should mention that in fact, and you, although you tell me if this is wrong, in fact there aren't any private detectives in China today. The government would not allow somebody to do that.
Private investigation is banned in China as a profession, but there are over thousands of private investigators, and they also have their annual conference But they are all operating under a different umbrella. For example, Mei Wang, my heroine, calls herself an information consultant.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting. So what do some of these the people who are actually doing this, what other kinds of jobs do they do, or do they say that they are doing?
Well, a lot of them set themselves up as consultants, and they provide security. They provide private investigation services. One of the biggest private investigation agencies in China is in Sichuan province, run by over 100 women, and they focus on catching cheating husbands and winning divorce cases for women in the province, and they're very successful.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, and of course, it somehow makes me, the fact that your character is a woman, it also makes me think a little bit of Alexander McCall Smith, who has written this very popular series of mysteries set in Africa, where his main character is a woman. Is there something, do you think, that as a storyteller gives you some advantage that you gain from the fact that your character is female?
For me, I feel very comfortable writing a female voice. And also, I wanted to write about the role of women and their family. And in May's case, and she's got a sister who's very wealthy and successful, and also a mother who's like a lot of mothers and critical of May. Having a female detective in this case just gives me all the opportunities to write about things that I really care about.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. I just was talking with a colleague who had read your books, and she just said that she thought that they would particularly appeal to women, because of those themes. And I guess I hadn't. I've read about half of the Eye of Jade, and I guess it didn't really. I didn't have that kind of reaction, but maybe being a man, I wouldn't. Do you think particularly, I don't know, I'm sure that you hear from people who have read the books, do you think that somehow there is something about them that is particularly appealing to women?
Perhaps the element that concerns with family and tradition and culture might be particularly appealing to women, because we all have that kind of struggle to deal with successful siblings, to deal with critical mothers, and also to deal with love and betrayal and hurt. I hope that men would find these stories also interesting, because in addition to that, there's also the crime, and there's also the social problems and social tragedies that happen in China on a daily basis. And I hope that also provides the interest to people who might just want something, a page-turner to read.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I want to make sure we get them in before we are out of time. This is someone listening in the community of Savoy, nearby, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was in China last summer. Well, I went with my granddaughter's band, and it was a lovely, lovely time. But I did read a book suggested by one of our guides called About the Wild Swans. Have you read that book?
Yes, I have. It's a wonderful
really,
book.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I'm now reading another book out of After China After Mao by a reporter. That's interesting, takes a story. And I will be happy to read yours. I thought China was a wonderful country. It certainly has progressed. I mean, the people, and it was lovely. Of course, we were there right before the Olympics, and it was very clean. And there wasn't a lot of pollution, which I'm sure can be a big problem. But it was very nice, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
We're almost out of time, unfortunately, but I'm curious about what your reaction to the Olympics was.
Oh, I was there for the entire duration of the Olympics. I think China did a wonderful job. It was highly organized, very effective. It was very much a sort of showcase of modern China. I'm glad this listener had a great time. I certainly had a great time. I think China is a wonderful country. It's full of history, full of tradition, and full of very kind people who unnecessarily had suffered quite a lot in their recent history.
Well, I'm sorry to say, will have to stop because we have used up all of our time. And I certainly would suggest that you might look for some of the books that we've talked about here. Lake with No Name, the memoir of her experiences growing up in China, Diane Weilang. The book was first published in 2003 and has just been brought out again for the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen. So that's published in paperback by Simon & Schuster. And you can look for her novels, The Eye of Jade. That was her first. That's also out in paper, published by Simon & Schuster. And then the second is Paper Butterfly. That's now in hardcover, also Simon & Schuster. And I'm expecting there will be more, will there?
Yes, I'm writing the third.
All right. Thanks very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest, Diane Weilang, she was talking with us from London, where she lives.